coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to today's Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will survey the lessons for the second Sunday after the Epiphany. And they are 1 Samuel chapter 3, verses 1 to 10, Psalm 139, verses 1 to 10, 1 Corinthians 6, verses 12 to 20, and the Gospel according to John the 1st, chapter, verses 43 to 51. And we begin, as we always do, with the Gospel lesson and David Weber, followed by comments and questions from Ethan Stoppenhagen.
I think at the center of this Epiphany text is Nathanael's question to Jesus, "How do you know me?" For some reason, the idea that Jesus was the Messiah seemed at first ridiculous to Nathanael. How could something as consequential as eternal salvation originate in the particular place of Nazareth or be brought about by the particular historical person, Jesus? Nathanael is dismissive of it. But then something changes with Nathanael in that he experiences what we'll call the glory of the particular. He's first offended by the particularity, but then he experiences the glory of the particular in that Jesus as a single individual is interested in knowing Nathanael. Of that whatever the work of the Messiah is, it is a personal knowing, and he asks, "How do you know me?" So the incarnation meant that the God of the universe had taken on flesh and blood in all its particularity, all of its scandalous particularity, in order for Christ to personally know single individuals like Nathanael and like us. So the scandal becomes the glory of salvation. What seemed ridiculous now seemed reasonable to Nathanael and even powerful. And then while Nathanael continued to fixate on how Jesus knew him, Jesus went on to disclose the implications. That because God had become flesh, because of the incarnation, because Jesus had condescended from heaven, heaven opened up. And that opening up of heaven opened up two-way traffic, first of angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man, and then Jesus inviting single persons to follow him, he being the way to follow on that path or that course that moves from flesh to immortality. The glory of salvation is that it doesn't have immediate glory. And this promised ascent to immortality, it helps us conceive of the Christian life as a curriculum. Now, I know that when we hear the word curriculum, we think of a course of study. But it's richer than that. The tradition, the history is richer. The original meaning of the word, where the word curriculum comes from, it was the course that the Roman chariots raced on. And so if we combine these image of an actual path, with a course of study in following Christ, which culminates in our immortality, we are on a course of continuing epiphany, of experiencing the truth and consequences of Christ's incarnation. And that takes place in physically and spiritually and intellectually. So I like the idea. I take comfort in Nathanael's first reaction to the incarnation as seeing it as ridiculous. It just seemed too small to accomplish the things that salvation is supposed to accomplish. And then that Nathanael recognized that the glory of this salvation is not that it's big, but that it comes to each of us personally with Christ intending to know us and calling us to follow him.
So I'm thinking a little bit more about this exchange between Nathanael and Jesus and this knowing, right? This knowing that Jesus has of Nathanael. Nathanael asks, "How do you know me?" And Jesus answered, I saw you under the fig tree. I saw you. And it elicits this confession from Nathanael, Rabbi, you are the Son of God.
Yeah, so what a change.
Yeah, well, and that's what it just seems utterly unbelievable that he, you know, that, and Jesus then says, you know, because I said I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? Is that what prompts then Nathanael's faith? I don't know. There's this connection between Jesus knowing us and Nathanael's faith that I'm trying to piece together.
Yeah, I will admit that the whole knowing thing didn't manifest itself until I turned to the psalm in which the psalm celebrates the craziness that God intends to know mortals, insignificant mortals. Then reading that back into the gospel lesson, you can see that Nathanael recognizing that the God of the universe taking interest in a single individual is ridiculous, but beautiful in a way, right? I mean, you begin to say, oh, this is how salvation should work. It should, as Mary says in the Magnificat, it should be able to go to the humble, to the inglorious. If it's a true ascent, it's going to go to the deepest parts of the earth in order to raise mortals to immortality. Maybe it's overemphasizing something that isn't in the text, but at least the idea that the incarnation, the glory of the incarnation is that there is this knowing. And the ongoing, Jesus makes it clear, you think this is good. The whole life of faith being a curriculum is going to reveal all sorts of things that you would never have understood. And that's why I think it fits well with the Epiphany season, is that it's raising our expectation. Yes, what we do in church seems humble and ridiculous and compared to the claims that we're making about this is where God is met. And yet, it's precisely the humbleness of the church that where you would expect something like the incarnation to carry on.
I love this. Maybe we're making a mountain out of a molehill, but this idea of knowledge, that Christ knowing us is what ultimately feeds our knowledge of him in those revelations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it changes everything. It's not that Nathanael is under obligation to know God. Now, the first thing is the craziness of the incarnation is that God condescends to know us. And like I said, I take great comfort in the fact that Nathanael is first, put off by that. You know, right. How ridiculously small of God. We need a God who is capable of, you know, wasting large armies of bozos, not getting to know people personally and intimately and slowly and all that. And again, as I mentioned, the psalm celebrates this idea that it is God's intention to know and be known by each of us personally. And especially when we remember in the Old Testament that the word to know also means to love intimately. So the psalm recognizes that God coming to know us is really the thing that satisfies our essential human desire to be loved and to love forever. That is how God expresses his love, in this ongoing knowing. And again, I'm going to side with Nathanael. It just seems ridiculous that what we offer on a Sunday morning is how God intends to get to know each of us and on this personal level, and to bring about this ascent to immortality. So I find the psalm paints a kind of humorous picture of God as a sort of personal groupie, that the psalmist says that God is familiar with all my ways, as if God is, you know, opening up the pages to the papers to see what new thing each individual is doing. And God is so attentive to us that the psalmist says he can finish my sentences before I even say them, because he knows what's on my tongue. And God is so committed to us that his presence in the life of the psalmist is that of patient edification and building up. And so the psalmist is expressing astonishment that God would condescend and see his role in our lives with these, as giving continual epiphanies about the truth and consequences of his love. And that love that we learn throughout life that his love has no limits, so that even if we bed in Sheol, God intends to be there. So the scandal of the particular, that's what I think Nathaniel was scandalized by, is that there is no single person and no particular place where God will not be present and to be present in his intention to know us.
I wonder if we should define knowing in a sense, because I think a lot of people think knowing in the sense of God's omniscience.
Yeah.
And that he knows everything. But this is a more intimate form of knowledge, right?
Yeah. And we can say those very words and it's not going to hit home.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I remember the number of times, and now it's just kind of a joke that the word know means is a term for, you know, sexual intimacy. And,
right.
And, you know, in grade school, we used to giggle at it. But the profundity of it that as Augustine made so clear, our deepest desire, which makes us vulnerable to all sorts of nonsense, is that we desire to be loved and to love. And we all believe that love should be eternal. This is, Augustine didn't think that's something that the Bible teaches you. It's something that life creates, this desire. And then, to make this connection that when Christ reveals himself in the flesh as the Word, this is meant to satisfy that deep desire to love and be loved. But you say that, then you wonder, well, okay, now what do I do? And I think it's just one of those things, is that's the nature of a promise. You know, you give the promise and it's not going to be fulfilled immediately, but the promise of Epiphany is that it will be fulfilled continually, mm-hmm. like the image of the curriculum. And maybe that's what it is, that we're just reminding ourselves that this is all part of the curriculum. There's not a single thing in life that will not be a teaching moment for God, or a revealing moment, or a moment in which we are brought into a closer relationship with God. And so the last thing we expect is for God to take interest in us, to become involved enough or intent enough to seek us out, or to speak to us, or to call us to follow him. And we have an example of this, and that the scripture says Eli was out of practice in hearing the Lord because the word of the Lord was rare. Eli was a priest, and we don't know the reason for it, but God had withdrawn, had become absent. And so Eli, like most people, began to think that the voice of God is something that would, not happen, not real. So once Eli made the connection that God was actually calling Samuel, he gives sage his advice. He says, do nothing. Go lie down and wait. Because if God is actually calling, then waiting is the most reasonable response. Because in waiting, then you are open to hear God speak. And if God is speaking personally, then something crucial and life-altering is going to be revealed. So if God actually comes to us, then in fact, waiting is reasonable. And that's what we try to do on Sunday morning. We try to have a scheduled experience in which not much happens, that we simply are in a position of using the ritual in order to wait on the Word of God to speak to us. And if the waiting proved fruitful, Samuel was to say something very similar to what Mary said to the angel when the birth of Jesus was announced. Samuel was to say, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. That is the sign that God, condescending, that God's incarnation has hit its mark. When we freely respond back and say, we are listening. And just a reminder, the word obedience, which sounds like such a harsh word, means literally to listen at a hyper level, to be utterly attentive. You can hear the word in obedience, hipakoe, the akuo, acoustics, to hear with intensity. So Eli expressed the long experienced desire of God's people for God to be present in his word. Little could have been imagined that God would satisfy this desire for his presence by becoming the word in the flesh. This gives us a kind of foretaste of the glory of the coming incarnation. So Eli's instruction alerted Samuel to expect that if God intends to meet us personally, if God intends to speak to us personally, then this will be life-changing and it will change life for the better. Again, I go back to Nathaniel saying, it seems ridiculous that God is going to do all this in the particular of a Sunday morning service, in the particular of the modest Christian life, and yet that is the promise that's delivered to us here. Mm-hmm. So what helps is, at first I just wanted to ignore this passage from Paul because of all the very harsh words on sexual promiscuity. And I just thought, I'm not going to talk about that in the sermon. But how does this 1 Corinthians cast light on, Christ's promise Christ coming to us with his promise of edification? And I think the key is that Paul makes it clear that God raised the Lord. Physically raise the Lord and will also raise us up. And if that's true, if physically we are going to experience resurrection, then the whole physical world of flesh and blood is changed. And Paul is, in this passage, begins to unpack what this change means. The incarnation opened heaven to us so that all of Christ's followers will follow the path that he established by his resurrection. That's the promise. This is what is central to Paul's mission, that we have hope because Christ has risen and the physical world has been changed. So what does it mean to live in this hope? What does it mean to practice the curriculum of ascent? Paul says it is not something that takes place in the soul. It doesn't take place in the mind. It engages body and soul together. We are a single unit as body and soul. So if life is really a path of ascent, then all of life has changed, including the physical bodily life. So Paul uses two examples. Food cannot be reducible to physical fuel. The beauty of food is that it is fuel, to be sure, for the body, but it's also a foretaste of the feast to come. Eating isn't meant to satisfy our hunger. Eating is meant to keep us hungry for eternity. It's to have a foretaste of what we say. It's just the little sample that gets us to the table. And then Paul turns to sexual intercourse. You can't reduce food to the physical, and you can't reduce intercourse to physical pleasure, because that physical pleasure, as Paul says, permits people to make playthings out of other people. And that is the very antithesis of what God intends in coming to earth. The incarnation isn't Christ taking advantage of us. Isn't Christ, it's Christ wanting to get to know each individual personally and to give them life eternal. So Christ came to earth in the flesh so that the flesh might be raised, not used and abused, and to follow him to immortality. And the fact of the incarnation means that our bodies are different now. Our bodies are not destined to the grave. Our bodies are characterized by the fact that we are God's temple. And God's temple is the place of a building, an epiphany, and of experiencing sacrificial love. And those things are the direct opposite of using the body as a temporary pleasure palace. And so, it's much easier to understand pleasure than it is to understand our bodies as the temple, except on the level of desire, when we really recognize what we desire. Paul makes clear our desires cannot be satisfied by any amount of promiscuity in this life. So later in chapter 15, Paul elaborates on this contrast. in that he argues that those who have no hope of immortality are under a tyrannical obligation to squeeze as much immoral pleasure by excessive eating and excessive drinking and excessive sexual promiscuity all before one dies. Paul recognizes that what looks like a party is actually nothing more than an expression of despair, of not having the satisfaction of immortality. And Paul recognizes that this is a kind of freedom that he has. He is free to not be sadly enslaved to death. That Paul is not fixing us with obligation. Rather, he is mapping out that Christ becoming incarnate opened up heaven, and that opening up of heaven is a freedom to us to experience the good, the true goodness of this life. And the true goodness of this life is not that it's the only life. It is the life that keeps us hungry for the eternal.
Thank you, David and Ethan. And thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.